Good morning. Thank you very much for getting up on a Saturday morning and schlepping all the way up that hill. We're going to get ready in a couple of minutes and get down to work. But first, Errol Solomon, one of my co-organizers, has a little announcement, a little reminder for you about some work that Jeff Salat is doing.
So Jeff Salat from Carleton has a survey that he'd like you to fill out about digital journalism, a course for digital journalism on digital journalism for mid-career journalists. So we put them in your welcome packages, and if you could please just fill those out and drop them off at the front by the door before you leave, that would be great. Thank you. And the survey does look like this. It's just one page.
Okay. Good. Another housekeeping matter. We have sign-up sheets for the workshops that we're going to be doing after this session. They are taped to the little sidebars downstairs by the table where your plates and your muffins were set up this morning. And if you haven't grabbed a muffin and a piece of fruit, please feel free to go downstairs. There's fruit juice, there's coffee. And just a quick word on the schedule for today. So we're going to have a really interesting case study of media policy in action. And that's the Open Media Group. And after that, we're going to break out into our workshop sessions for a couple of hours. We're going to break for lunch. Then we're going to come back upstairs into this room. And we're going to talk about what each group talked about, make a plan, and go forward. So I will just throw it open to you guys. I think you guys are going to handle your own moderation this morning, right?
Yes,
okay,
please.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Well, good morning, everybody. Oh, no, I stand. We're okay?
Yeah, we'll sit down.
Okay, we'll sit down. Well, I think we'll sit down if we may. So good morning. Bon matin. Welcome to the panel on open media and media reform in Canada. Before we get started, I just want to say thanks very much to the organizers for a great conference so far. Great presentations, good discussion yesterday. I hope to carry it forward today, of course. My name's David Skinner. I'm chair of the Department of Communication Studies at York University, and I'm the Anglophone moderator of this panel this morning.
Et bonjour, je m'appelle Karen Wersig. Je travaille à la Guide canadienne des médias et je sers aujourd'hui de modérateur de langue française ainsi que de conférencière.
So the purpose of the panel this morning is to provide some background on contemporary currents in media reform, generally in Anglophone Canada. We also want to frame the work of open media in this context, and in particular, highlight how that work relates to the themes of the conference, particularly how it relates to both the practice of journalism and the shifting dimensions of the profession in the online environment.
Nos guides dans la discussion sont le professeur Robert Hackett, à ma gauche, de l'Université de Simon Fraser. Comme vous le savez peut-être, Bob a écrit beaucoup au sujet de la réforme des médias anglophones canadiens. Et nous expliquerons le contexte historique des mouvements de réforme et dans ce contexte, l'établissement de Open Media.
And of course, we have Karen, who you probably know from her presentation yesterday. And Karen is herself an experienced journalist. In her current role at the Canadian Media Guild, she represents journalists at a number of organizations, including CBC Radio Canada. And she's also been quite active in animating media reform in a number of capacities. And she'll be discussing two campaigns that open media has been active in and their implications, particularly for journalism in Canada.
Et finalement, nous sommes heureux de vous présenter Leslie Regan-Shea de l'Université Concordia, département d'études en communication. Leslie a bien sûr écrit beaucoup au sujet de la réforme dans le secteur, ainsi que sur les politiques relatives à l'Internet, les médias et les télécommunications, donc le terrain dans lequel le journalisme évolue. Elle a préparé un entretien avec le personnel d'Open Media au sujet de leur stratégie journalistique.
So now I'll maybe just carry on from here to give a brief introduction to Open Media and their work. So how many of you are familiar with with Open Media, right? So a good number, right? That's good. So as I know Bob will be telling us, Open Media basically started in Vancouver in 2007, largely through the work of Steve Anderson, who was an MA student at Simon Fraser at the time. As a number of people have pointed out over the last couple of days, whatever the future of journalism, to a large part, it probably hinges on basically an open and accessible internet, right? And everybody having access to the internet and web tools, et cetera, right? And this is really what now the work of open media focuses upon. So I think that's why it's quite pertinent for us here today, right? But it didn't start that way. I mean, the first campaigns were related to broadcasting and focused largely on CRTC hearings. And the first one was the Diversity of Voices hearing in 2007. And later, we moved to the community television hearing. And these campaigns set up basically a base for the organization, and it began to attract support from a range of other organizations at that time, right? A lot of NGOs and individuals, right? But in May 2008, they launched the Save Our Net campaign in defense of net neutrality and held quite a widely publicized public demonstration on Parliament Hill. And this really marked the move toward a stronger focus on internet-related issues, right? The big breakthrough, though, came with the Stop the Meter campaign in 2010. And you might remember this campaign took on the move by the large telcos or internet providers to introduce usage-based billing. And over the course of 3 or 4 months, it had really incredible traction. Like, I remember actually talking to Steve on the phone about it. He said, we have 45,000 signatures. A couple hours later, we got 75,000 signatures, right? And it moved up. So when it got to February, the online petition had over 300,000 signatures, right? So it was really by far the largest online organization at the time, right? And the CRTC then, and under the weight of that, basically took the unusual step of changing what had been seen as basically a fait accompli decision in favor of the big telcos to one that has been characterized as a much more friendly to other stakeholders in the system. Right? And while that issue is still somewhat in play, not entirely in play, but the issue is still somewhat in play, and that petition now has over 500,000 signatures on it, right? So it's really quite a thing. Now, while they've yet to match that number with more contemporary campaigns, I mean, that's provided that that mail list has been an incredible resource. And more recent campaigns have been drawing 60,000 to 70,000 people on average, right? So they've really set, I think, a new standard for online organizing. Now, we can look at later or more contemporary campaigns a bit later if we have time, right? But given these successes, I mean, OM's work, I'd say Open Media OM, that's the shorthand, right? Has been recognized with a national award by the Canadian Internet Registry Association, and now is actually often consulted by regulators and policymakers on a number of internet-related issues. Right? They do have a very small number of staff, though. They started out with like 1.5 people, and now they're up to 3.5 people. But the way that they're able to manage is because they work quite collaboratively with their constituencies. And in fact, they call themselves basically citizen-driven, and they frame their campaigns as both community-led and really crowdsourced. Now, just to step back for a sec from that, as I think that the key factors in open media success are largely their messaging and their tactics. And these will be discussed in the presentation, but I just want to briefly touch upon them at the moment, right? So as you may know, I mean, OM's campaigning involves much more than just petitions, right? It's not like an avaz or whatever per se. Right? Facebook has played a key role in developing this community, and Open Media has almost 87,000 likes on Facebook. And people regularly comment on issues and campaign strategies, and then they share these with their friends, right? And in conjunction with social media spreading the message, there are ongoing media strategies such as newspaper ads and letters to the editor. And these are often targeted to MPs or elected officials in their home ridings. And then those tactics are combined with lobbying of both elected and non-elected officials and a range of other sort of personal contact tactics as well, right? But Open Media's relationship with both their supporters and the media, I think, are somewhat different from traditional activist organizations. Right? Through social media, I mean, they've had tremendous success in sourcing ideas and materials that are used in their campaigns. And working through social media, videos, graphics, and labor power for campaigns are often donated or volunteered by people who've been inspired by the larger campaign. And they end up often, I mean, I've been surprised, like they'll often get like broadcast quality video from people just donated, right? Mm-hmm. And then in turn, they're able to use that video to send it out to different organizations who will, you know, use it for public service messages and stuff like that. And people have just responded to them in really interesting ways, right? So this has really led Open Media to have a much more collaborative view of the relationship between their supporters and the sort of central organization than I think many traditional sort of activist organizations, right? And in turn, this relationship has also inspired, I think, a somewhat different perspective on media, right, and journalism, as blogs, YouTube, and other forms of online publishing, right, to a degree, really take the place of traditional media representation. Right? And again, for one of the key points for our purposes here, I think, is the role that these social networks play in both the construction and dissemination of their message. I mean, to agree, that, like both bypassing and supplanting, really, the role of traditional media, right, in terms of organizing and publicity. And while they do use so traditional or legacy media in traditional ways, traditional media really play an adjunct and maybe even diminishing role in their overall campaign strategy. And while, you know, this isn't a new idea, I mean, obviously we've been talking about it for the last couple of days here, I mean, I think the degree, right, to which Open Media is moving in this direction is really, you know, unprecedented. Like, they're really, I think, you know, to use an old phrase, on the leading edge, right, of this kind of stuff. At least maybe as an old guy, that's how I see it anyway. Right, right, that part of it. Anyway, I think we'll leave the intro here now. But before we start, we should probably have a little disclosure. Right? Like all of us on the panel have been active with Open Media pretty much since its inception. In fact, Karen, Leslie, and I, we sit on the board, and Bob was one of the founding board members. So we do have some relationship with the organization. Like we'll have to admit that, right? Yeah. So in terms of how we proceed, I think we'll have Bob go first, followed by Karen, and then Leslie, and then any questions or discussion at the end, if we may, please.
Okay, thank you, David. I should say I wasn't on the board of Open Media as such, but I was one of the founders that got it off the ground in 2007, which I'll explain in a moment. But I'd just like to give a bit of the background, going back perhaps 100 years, very briefly, and I'm not going to, in detail, I won't give you a blow-by account of the last century, but I do want to jump back about almost 100 years now, because I think there are precedents in English Canada, and I make it clear, I'm talking about Troc, the rest of Canada, because I think Quebec has a very distinct activist milieu, a very distinct society, of course. So I may make some comparisons there. There aren't always favorable to Anglo-Canada, I must say, in terms of media activism. But the precedents do go back to the Canadian Radio League, at least, in the 1920s, and the formation of public broadcasting in Canada, arguably even further than that, to campaigns for the public ownership of telephone systems, certainly in the prairies, a century ago. So media reform activism is not completely new in Canada. What is, of course, new, as David suggested, are the forms and the strategies and the frames that it is taking. But I think after the Canadian Radio League in Anglo-Canada for a half century, there was really just a low level of specifically media-oriented policy activism after really the formation of the CBC. And I think that to the extent there has been communications-oriented advocacy from a public interest perspective in Anglo-Canada, it has tended to come from relatively professional, relatively middle-class or elite sections of the population. Basically, one could characterize it as liberal middle-class reformism for much of the 20th century. And that's by contrast with Quebec since the 1960s, where you have a much higher degree of political polarization around social, class, and national questions, a much higher profile for understandable reasons of culture and language as political issues, a richer field of interaction between alternative media and popular movements. And Mark Raboy, of course, has written about this in an excellent little book a few decades ago called Movements and Messages. It's worth checking out. So what accounts for the lower level of media activism in Anglo-Canada during that period, the 1960s to 80s, compared to Quebec? and for the relative lack of grassroots or movement involvement in media policy advocacy. I think several factors come into play. One is a sort of Marshall McLuhan-inspired overconfidence in the liberating potential of handheld media, which is still with us. You know, the idea that we've got the internet, why do we need media activism? And at the time, there was all kinds of, hype about handheld cameras, you know, that were going to revolutionize communication, democratize it, and so on. Every new technology has this kind of, seems to have this kind of impact, right? We look at the wonderful things we can do with it. We don't need to worry about media ownership or, you know, political power, because the technology by itself will solve the problems, which, of course, it never does, unless you look at the bigger political and economic framework. Also, I think at the time, the 60s and 70s, a good deal of optimism about movement's ability to influence dominant media frames. It's arguable that the media, dominant traditional media at that time, news media, were more open to advocates of social change than they are today. And one thinks of the relationship, for example, between the Daily Vancouver Sun and the formation of Greenpeace in the late 60s and early 70s. In fact, Bob Hunter, one of the founders of Greenpeace, was a columnist with the Vancouver Sun. And social movements at the time in English Canada, where, again, the cultural and linguistic question doesn't come into play the same way it does in Quebec, they had other fish to fry: the Vietnam War, Anglo-Canadian nationalism vis-a-vis the United States, struggles against poverty in cities, and so on. They did not see communication policy as a major issue or a primary problem. And indeed, it seemed like the dominant traditional media system was working reasonably well from a progressive viewpoint. We had the National Film Board and its Challenge for Change program. We still had a relatively strong CBC. It was the era of the post-war social contract, with government seen as a socially constructive force, offsetting market failures and corporate power. Still, in English Canada, there was growing unease about media concentration by the 1970s and its impact on the quality of journalism in particular. And this was reflected in a sort of a sequence, a trickle of federal government reports, the Davy Committee from the Senate in 1970, the Kent Royal Commission on Newspapers in 1980-81 that I think was mentioned yesterday, and several task forces on broadcasting policy, sometimes dealing with content culture and indeed broadcast journalism. So in Quebec, you have mass mobilization, you have a common front of militant unions, you have the movement for community radio. In Anglo-Canada, you have Senate reports, okay, which is, you know, maybe putting it a little stereotypically, but that seems to be the kind of contrast. This begins to change, I think, in the 1980s. When we have the hegemony of neoliberalism, you have Mulroney's free trade agreement, you have more and more language of marketization and privatization, with at least this implicit attack and eventually explicit attack on the value of public service broadcasting, for example, and many of the institutions that the left had taken for granted became under attack. And in 1985, you have the formation of the Friends of Canadian Broadcasting, dedicated to supporting the CBC and the principles of public broadcasting. It was still a somewhat treetop rather than grassroots approach. It has supporters and not members, but nevertheless, that's not a criticism. That's the nature of its organizational mode. And it built a fairly broad base of support with something like, I think, 60,000 supporters, regular supporters and donors. And in the 1990s, you have seismic shifts in the newspaper industry, more mergers. You have the emergence of right-wing press baron Conrad Black. And one could hardly imagine, and I hear from Leslie's groan here, to make my point, you could hardly imagine a more perfect villain to stimulate mobilization on the part of the left, right? So by 1996, you have the formation of something called the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, modeled on a British organization of that name that has been quite impressively active since 1979 in the UK. And the CPBF in Canada formed a common front of the Council of Canadians, of trade unions, of other NGOs and citizens groups to challenge Conrad Black and his Hollinger Incorporated takeover of what was at the time the Southern newspaper chain. Well, the CPBF as such, as a national force, faded after about 1 year after it unsuccessfully challenged that takeover on Charter of Rights grounds. But it had put media reform perhaps for the first time in a generation or two, squarely on the progressive agenda. And it left an ongoing active chapter in Vancouver that Dave Skinner and I were actively involved in. It involved individuals from academia, from trade union locals, particularly the media union CEP, Adbusters magazine, the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, basically individuals from these groups, more than the organizations themselves, but we had a very productive nucleus for several years. And we were focused largely on journalism and media ownership issues. We did challenges to the BC Press Council, which frankly, I'll say this on the record, is a bit of a joke, right? Self-regulation doesn't seem to work any better here than it does in Britain. And in 1999, we heard about this newfangled thing called the World Wide Web. Has anybody ever heard of that? We thought this would be great. Yeah, yeah. It'll never last, right? It won't catch on. And we thought it would be great to set up a journalism review, actually, and try to be the go-to place for journalism critique, at least in BC, without realizing, you know, what kind of resources it takes to keep that, not only to produce an issue of a journal, but to keep it updated. And also to promote it, because, you know, it didn't take too long until there were, you know, something like 6 billion websites, right, that we're competing with. But we were inspired by the indie media centers that emerged after the Battle of Seattle, the WTO protests in 1999, and that seemed to be something, a way to go. But the website didn't work as such, but we had much more success with another event, another avenue. And that was the annual Media Democracy Day, which we started in 2001, and we've been doing ever since. And that's been enormously successful, at least as a local event. It brings together independent media makers, community organizations, unions, librarians, academics, and students under the slogan of Know the Media, Be the Media, Change the Media. So we celebrate media literacy, media policy reform, and independent media, with journalism as one focus amongst others. But it remained the case that there's still, at that time, no national umbrella group for democratic media reform. And this led to an initiative at the University of Windsor Conference in 2007, which was to celebrate the work of Chomsky and Herman, both, which most of you know, I'm sure, and who were both in attendance at that conference. And I got up and pleaded for a national organization to change the media system in Canada so that Chomsky and Herman wouldn't have to keep writing books, you know, denouncing the propaganda function of the dominant media. And about 50 of us met there, and it was my former student, one of whom I'm, you know, extremely proud. It was Steve Anderson who stepped up to the bat and basically devoted his life over the next few years to getting this new organization off the ground. So open media evolved from that moment as it sought and found a niche in the organizational ecology of democratic media activism. It went through a name change from the Campaign for Democratic Media to Open Media, a growing focus on digital media issues and policy. The initial vision was very wide-ranging and not particularly focused. It was about all democratic relevant media issues. A mode of organizing that David has already described that's distinct from either the treetops NGOs or institutes or membership-based NGOs like the Council of Canadians. And it emerged partly in response, that strategy and its frames emerged partly in response to a survey of about 75 activists in media and other NGOs in Canada about their priorities, strategies, challenges, partnerships and achievements, as well as their uses and perceptions of digital and news media. And that was a survey we did, I think, in 2009 in partnership with an organization called WAC Global, the World Association for Christian Communication, which is actually ecumenical. It's a development organization. It's not particularly a religious organization, with Open Media and myself as the academic coordinator. And we found that by contrast with the United States, after the Iraq War and the emergence of Fox News, in Canada, corporate news media are not a shared grievance of progressive groups in Anglo-Canada. And I suppose those of you who are journalists can take some comfort in that you're not seen as the villain, the way that journalism in corporate media in the States is seen, I think, by large parts of the American left. But at the same time, non-government organizations in Canada are aware of the importance of their access and representation in news media. There's some evidence that groups that were more dissatisfied with media's democratic performance or with their own organization's coverage are more likely to engage in media reform activism. But what did emerge even more clearly, though, was that affordable access to the internet was a crucial issue for almost every NGO, right? That was their life and death. That was their bread and butter. And we determined from the survey of the different sectors that were involved in this survey, very initial findings, but it seemed that the most likely allies for media reform were going to be independent media, arts and culture groups, trade unions, and advocacy groups for human rights, as well as broadly focused, broadly based progressive organizations. But the full report can be found, I think it's still online, I haven't checked recently. It was called Revitalizing a Media Reform Movement in Canada. This is about 2 years ago. And it was on the website at one point, or the links are on the Open Media website, the WACC Global, W-A-C-C, WACC Global website, and also the Media Hub for the Social Science Research Council. I'm sorry, I'm probably taking up too much time, so I'll move.
No.
Okay.
There's also the CJC article that you
wrote. Thank you. Leslie reminds me that we also produced a shorter version of that report for the Canadian Journal of Communication that was co-edited by, I think, Leslie and Becky Lentz. Is that right? And that was about a year ago?
Yeah. Free archive.
Yeah, so it's online, free archive, so that you can find a summary of it there as well, Canadian Journal of Communication. So that was, you know, a sort of a shift in focus for open media, a greater degree of focus on digital issues in particular. And after 2007, open media launched a number of campaigns which other people on this panel will discuss. My final comments are about how open media is relevant to journalism, and a couple of points here. One is that it has influenced the profile and framing of communications issues in mass media. And I think, with due respect to what Dave said, and I agree with the shift in the media ecology that David described, the conventional media are still very important since television in particular is still the main source of news for Canadians. And data show that, you know, that hasn't changed much really since 1996. It's still the case that about 60% of Canadians turn to television news first as their primary source of news. And open media has been reasonably successful and active in dealing with that medium. I mean, it's great to see my former student up there on the national news, right, advocating for an open media system. So that's part of the key, I think, has been an important part of their success, is sort of validating their issues by gaining access to conventional media that brings it to a broader attention, you know, a broader constituency than those who use the internet frequently. And it's also partly by using concepts that already resonate in neoliberal discourse, concepts like innovation, competition, and choice in their framing of messages, and then trying to rework or retorque them towards different policy implications. That's a difficult game. It's fraught with, you know, potential for backfiring. But nevertheless, I think, you know, if it's approached with some nuance and skill, that's an important opening to use. Okay, so you turn, if you like, corporate and conservative rhetoric against itself in favor of other kinds of policies, a kind of political judo, if you like. And they've also been willing to accept a framing of open media itself as a consumer rights group or an internet defender rather than as a media reform or media, democratic media organization. In fact, it's interesting that the word democracy hardly ever appears, at least from what I've seen, in open media literatures. It's almost as if that's seen as too political a concept, which, if that's the case, we are in somewhat trouble, you know, if we can't use that as a sort of a principle that we all share. But nevertheless, Steve has pointed quite rightly, Steve Anderson, I think, is in my conversations with him, pointed to a gap in the ecology of media activism in Canada by comparison with the United States. Open media is less concerned with the content of mass media and more with its access and architecture. And partly that's because we don't have the basis for content-oriented political activism around media issues in Canada. We do not, unlike the United States, we don't have organizations like FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or Project Censored, that engage in critical analysis of the ongoing news agenda and its biases or distortions or omissions. And therefore, there's no organization that's on an ongoing basis conscientizing social movements about how the still dominant media corporations, in particular television, are framing their issues. Okay, so that's a gap. I mean, Newswatch Canada tried to do that, but it's you know, for a number of years, I'm a co-director of Newswatch Canada at Simon Fraser University. But the amount of labor and money you'd need to do that on an ongoing basis is quite considerable. The only organization that's done that consistently over the last 20 years is the neoliberal Fraser Institute, with quite some success, actually, in sort of getting inside the heads of managers at CBC and saying that, and convincing themselves that we really have to watch out for that left liberal bias. And boy, have they ever, right? They have really gone in the other direction. Just as an aside, I just think that, you know, for some of my colleagues, the national on TV news has become almost unwatchable, populated with, you know, people like Kevin O'Leary. He's maybe not in the national that much, but, you know, Andrew Coyne, very intelligent, but very consistently neoliberal. And then there's the elusive Rex Murphy, right? Oh. Sort of combines reactionary politics with an unquestioned command of the English language. I think he's demonstrated that he's a new species of dinosaur. That I would call him Tyrannothesaurus Rex. How's that? Okay? If you use that, just give me a footnote. Tyrannothesaurus Rex. But there's nobody doing that kind of critique of the political dimensions, right, of our aspects of coverage in the news on an ongoing basis. But what I would say is that open media, this is my final point, its relevance to journalism is also that it advocates policies and conscientizes broad constituencies, particularly younger digital users, policies that if successful would create an institutional context much more favorable, in particular to small-scale experimental community and citizen journalism, right? But also to those who want to access dominant media as well. So that's basically, I'll leave it for there, and I hope later we might discuss some of the implications for practice that emerge out of the experience of open media. Thank you.
So I'll pick up on the thread that follows from our first campaign together, which was the campaign on the diversity of voices at the CRTC, which came about right on the heels of the Windsor conference that Bob mentioned. At that time in 2007, we were in the midst of a frenzy of broadcast mergers and really a lot of concern across the country, despite not having a sort of a singular voice to represent that concern, a lot of concern across the country about the concentration of private media ownership and the growing concentration and where would it end. And of course, it hasn't ended. As we noticed, as I mentioned yesterday, we are three mergers away from an effective broadcast monopoly in Canada. And it's not clear we're going to stop until we get there. So what we did was we were able to go online, use a list of media activists that our parent union had already been developing in Canada on a bunch of issues, mostly related to Conrad Black, because a bunch of our members worked for Conrad Black and we're not happy about it, and built from that, people shared it around, a campaign to participate in the CRTC process. And it's not that common for normal people to participate in CRTC processes. I'm like one of the most normal people who goes to those. Kathy and I are probably the most normal people who go to those hearings. And we're not that normal either. We're kind of geeky. But usually it's a lot of rich lawyers. And if you're not a rich lawyer in a very dark suit sitting before them with a red tie on, you look like you're from another planet. But all these people wrote in, thousands of people wrote into the CRTC, and yes, we gave them a model letter, but they varied their letter. We urged them, vary your letter and say what is actually happening in your community about the loss of a diversity of editorial voices. And boy, did people write. I mean, I think geographically the biggest groups we got were from BC, which was obvious. Canwest owned everything in BC at that time, it seemed like. The Irvings owned everything in New Brunswick. So I think there were a few highlights. New Brunswick and BC were the most ticked off. We got a lot of letters from Toronto, and
even from Montreal, even though I would say Toronto and Montreal are still among the best served for a diversity of media in the continent, perhaps in the, you know, among the best in the world, perhaps, which is kind of interesting. But people saw this. People, even in the big cities who had come from small towns or whose parents still live in small towns, wrote about the problems in their small towns. So we realized this was a real problem of a few regions in the country and small town Canada. And that, I mean, because so many of our members work in public broadcasting, we also were very conscious of the fact that public broadcasting remains a very important antidote to this idea of just the private media taking over everything. So what has followed from that thread, and I think the CRTC was a bit struck by this participation, and people started to actually go to CRTC hearings again. I mean, this was a kind of a new thing. The open media people went, and other people went. It sort of, I think, ushered in, I don't know if open media did this on its own, but it did usher in a new era of normal people going to CRTC hearings. And what the CRTC actually did move a little bit. They set up the Local Program Improvement Fund in the years following that hearing. And I think there was a very direct line, and they've always used this diversity of voices idea as the reason for the Local Program Improvement Fund. And this week I was at that hearing, and they are reviewing the fund, and there is a, the cable companies don't want to pay into it anymore, so there is the possibility that they could kill it. But that sense of the diversity of voices and the echoes of all those people who are concerned about what's going on in their local communities is still very much there. And half of the commissioners, not the other half, but half of the commissioners on the panel reflected that. And that's also really interesting, that that's still there. The other thread, and open media participated in that process as well and signed on to a series of, under the name Reimagine CBC, signed on to a series of principles about keeping this support for local programming. So that's that. The content stuff or the support for broadcasting is still there. The other thread is what's up on the board, which is something that our union worked with initially with Open Media to reimagine CBC, knowing that we were heading into this very difficult year of 2012 with a federal budget that was going to we kind of knew there was going to be no way to avoid cuts this year at the CBC, although we tried. We set up an online petition, 35,000 people have signed it, against cuts. But more to the point, we can't just keep saving the old dinosaur, right? We actually have to give it new life. And so that's the exciting thing, I think, about this campaign. It's forward-looking. Reimagining CBC is about getting people, hopefully, in a range of demographics, not people who remember growing up on the prairies with their radio, like my dad, right, who grew up on the prairies with his radio and will give money to support CBC, you know, every week if you asked him, but also people who never thought that CBC was something they had to fight for. And there are a lot of people, right? There are a lot of people in the country who grew up, they might have even been part of their lives growing up, but have never thought about it as something they needed to fight for or think about. And the way this campaign has been framed is to say, public media is ours, and we need to take control of what, not can take control of public media, but take control of what the idea is and take it back from the Fraser Institute. Take it back from those people who just say it's, you know, a market distortion that doesn't need to exist anymore because we have the internet. And so what I'll say is there's a little bit of a tension in open media about this because there are a bunch of libertarians who, you know, who do support open media who think because we have the internet, why would we pay for public media? On the other hand, there's a lot of media activists within open media who are very excited about this campaign. And so it's done under the banner of Reimagine CBC. And I think it's the other thread beyond the open internet stuff, and it's combined through a kind of a look at a digital future for CBC, but it's combined there, but it's the other thread of really looking at our media system and the content system, the content side of our media system, and thinking about and being active on how it should move into the future to serve all of us. So I'll end it there.
Et ça existe aussi une campagne un peu plus raccourcie, réinventant Radio-Canada, et la pétition existe en français aussi, au site. La conversation est un peu plus n'est pas aussi chargé qu'en anglais, mais ça existe quand même en français, des renseignements et la pétition. Voilà, voilà, oui, les amis de Radio-Canada, tous amis de Radio-Canada, oui, c'est ça. Et ça, c'est très intéressant aussi. Ça existe un blog en ligne et beaucoup d'activités, surtout au Québec. Oui.
Okay. Oh, so you need to come in.
Yeah, but just before I thank you, Karen, and thanks, Bob and David for all the presentations. It's sort of interesting, particularly to hear the sort of panoramic historical sweep of media reform and in Canada and bringing it back. What I want to do is talk a bit about the backbone of open media. As David has mentioned, there's, he mentioned there's, what, 3.5 staff at open media. There's actually 4, but one is sort of working half-time, so I suspect that's a half a person, but it sounds kind of, you know, unique who is this half person. So many of you know, the executive director is Steve Anderson, who appears in the media a lot. But there's also Riley Yeo, who's the managing director, and Lindsay Pinto, who's a communications manager, and Shay Sinnott, who is the operations manager. And I really wanted one of the staff members to talk about what they do, because it's way more interesting than, you know, me talking about what I think, because they're actually doing all of this stuff. They're involved in a day-to-day basis, and they do a fabulous job. Do you want to bring it up full screen? So, sorry, my technical expert here is, so I asked Lindsay, and David and I thought of a few questions to ask Lindsay about the role of open media in terms of journalism. And so she made this short video that I'd like to show. And we'll make sure that it gets all tiki-boo here. Okay. So can I put it full screen? Yeah. Video, full screen. You ready? Yes? Okay.
Hi, my name is Lindsay Pinto. I'm the communications manager at openmedia.ca, and I've been asked to speak to you about some of the ways that we at openmedia.ca engage with mainstream media and social media when we do our campaigning. So procedure-wise, I'm just going to answer a few of the questions that were suggested by one of our highly esteemed board members, Leslie Reagan-Shade. So our advice to you on this would be to start at ground level. Engage with your community first and the media second. Building momentum and growing your numbers is key in getting media attention, especially when communicating relatively complex issues like telecommunications policy. Public outcry is often a better hook than a policy qualm, and more understandable. We saw this especially clearly early in our StopTheMeter.ca campaign, which aimed to put a stop to widespread usage-based billing in Canada. The petition we launched seemed to tap into a wellspring of anger about telecommunications in Canada. People are very upset about the lack of choice in the internet market, the high prices, the disrespectful customer service, you name it. And so the petition, understandably, quickly gained momentum. On its own, the Stop the Meter petition did fairly well with press coverage, but those who signed the petition and engaged with us via social media were really the ones who made it count. We had reports that supporters were writing letters to the editors of their local papers, something for which we now have a tool, and even going so far as to call journalists to ask for more campaign coverage. After Parliament resumed last fall, we knew we had to scale up our campaign against the warrantless online spying bill C-30. So we called on the pro-internet community, which is our community of supporters, to educate their fellow Canadians through short, volunteer-made YouTube videos. Those videos have now been viewed over 120,000 times. They've been picked up by national TV news on several occasions, and they were the subject of a great deal of chatter on social media. That same campaign also spurred the creation of the trending hashtags Tell Vic Everything and Don't Tase Me, Bro. When we asked Canadians to spread the word on social media, we were expecting a lot of retweets and relatively simple shares, and so we were pleasantly surprised to see the creativity, ingenuity, and hilarity of the tweets that people use to engage others in what would otherwise be a fairly inaccessible legal issue. Our theory is that this is all about seeing the hooks. It's newsworthy when Canadians take to Twitter to protest an issue. And legacy journalists are also on Twitter looking for the latest stories and trying to get them as soon as possible, trying to help them out with a press release or a phone call, in addition to curating social media content, can go a long way. Well, we at openmedia.ca like to think of ourselves as connection buffs. We love watching our community interact on social media, and we love being a part of that interaction. Conversing with people via social media and generally being accessible via email or phone are key parts of our engagement strategy. We at openmedia.ca hope that our work leads to journalism that is more citizen-centric. We hope to spread the idea of more crowdsourced, participatory journalism. And through digital tools such as blogging, photo uploading, and video sharing, we want to encourage everyday Canadians to take a more active role in newsmaking in Canada going forward. Well, that's everything for me. Thank you for watching. I hope this was helpful. If you do have any questions or you want to follow up with me, please do feel free to send me an email at Lindsay, L-I-N-D-S-E-Y, at openmedia.ca. I hope you do come and check out our website and have a good rest of conference.
So, a round of applause for Lindsay, who I think it's just great that she could do that. Regarding her short video, I put together a few screenshots of things that she mentioned. This is the website, main site of Open Media. That's the page about us, talking about who's involved. Here's a screenshot of the staff. Here's some people involved in the Open Media Network. Here are some of the Stop Online Spying campaign members. So it's really served as a very effective organization, almost an umbrella group, bringing together different sorts of organizations involved in digital policy issues that have a wide spread and scope and impact in Canada. Here's the Stop Telecom Price Gouging Mind the Cap site. Open Media has received lots of mainstream media coverage. And here's just a few screenshots on CBC News. They're mentioned the Vancouver Sun, Financial Post. Here's the letter writing tool that was mentioned. Here's the site for the Stop Online Spying campaign. Here's one of the very highly effective videos that was made. They're very funny. Okay, yes. Humor is a really important aspect because digital policy issues can be, you know, they're very crucial, but they can be, you know, they're kind of boring sometimes. And so you've got to have, as Lindsay said, the hook. What is the hook? And humor is fabulous. Now, with Bill C-30, there's a whole way, the cyber surveillance bill, that humor was used in effective way. So hilarity is important. This is a SFU Open Media Club, so a lot of young people, and Bob did mention this as well, you know, Open Media is engaging lots of, you know, so-called digital natives, unlike us digital immigrants. I hate those terms, but it's just really engaging lots of young people in terms of digital policy issues. Here's a great video a young gentleman made about Stop Unwarranted Online Spying. That's quite hilarious. This is a repercussions of what happens when Bill C-30 passes, although that could be the streets of Montreal nowadays. And this is, you know, Ceiling Vic, so it's sort of using memes and whatnot. And if you just do Google News searches and just plug in open media and just try to see how much stuff is coming up and how they've been effective in able to get the word out in different sorts of media, it's a great, you know, thesis topic for a student if they want to do that. But anyway, I think I'll just leave it at that. And if you have other questions to the panel, I think we're ready to engage in those. Yes, Dave?
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you. So we can open it up now?
Sure.
Yeah, just two comments on something you guys said and then a question. One was just in terms of Bob's comments that media activism was kind of dead in English Canada throughout the 60s, I did just want to point out from the point of view of the community television sector that was the time when you did mention Challenge for Change, but that did lead to a community television policy in English and French Canada, although in some ways has missed fire because it was placed under cable company control. For 20 years, it was viewed as a successful experiment, and it did spawn the idea of community television around the world. So that was a significant achievement from the period. And the other thing that was interesting, what Karen said about the diversity of voices hearing, you believe it led to commissioners coming up with the LPIF. Mm-hmm. Funnily enough, the day that I appeared at the LPIF on Wednesday last week, the person that went before me, which was... it was Télérive, it was one of the Quebec broadcasters, had used the term diversity, you know, you need diversity, the small players need to be in, and Len Katz said, where does it say in any LPIF documentation that the point of the fund was to encourage diversity? Because I thought I had read it anyway, so that was just a point, is that for some reason he went out of his way to put on the record, I don't know that the LPIF was ever supposed to be about diversity, so it's something that we need to look into. Yeah. Then my question to do with open media is, as you mentioned, the open media supported us in advance of the 2010 Community Media Policy Review. They took it on as a campaign, which was terrific for us. It resulted in 3,000 letters going to the CRTC. They and also Friends mobilized their network to help bring public awareness because we didn't have an email list at that time. And one thing that came up at that point, which I wondered if you feel has been a net plus of open media, is during that campaign, people had told us, you know, if you're trying to get change out of the CRTC and you're a small organization, you know, using inflammatory language to them and about, you know, their people who they often view as their clients, big cable, isn't going to help them. These are the people who can give you the change that you want. So, for example, one of the press releases that in language on the open media site to help mobilize our letter writing campaign was, stop the big cable ripoff and this kind of language. And I've ended up on the fence. You know, Steve's been tremendously successful, it appears, with that kind of language. And yet I didn't know for my issue, you know, I didn't have this backing of this, you know, huge upswell of people with the internet. You know, community media has become kind of a sleeper policy, community TV, whether that was going to work for us. So I'd really like your opinion on whether you think that kind of inflammatory, hit them with 400,000 and be really critical in your language works when you're trying to get change out of CRTC commissioners. Like, they were sort of forced to by the hammer of public opinion. Does that work every time?
We have more campaigns to do, too.
Well, I think that's really interesting because, I mean, I can remember the first time as a board member that I turned on, and, you know, as a board, we're supposed to be hands-off in many ways, like they do their own thing, right? So I remember looking on the site, and they were using the word gouging, and I thought, oh, my God, they're talking about the telecom companies gouging consumers. Like, maybe that's libelous. I better check and see maybe she call a lawyer, right? And then and some of that language was really inflammatory. And then I noticed though last week the Ontario government started using the term gouging by saying that telecoms companies were gouging consumers. And I thought that was really interesting that the same language that had seemed to be so outrageous like a year ago was all of a sudden being taken up by the state, right? Like, it was that was an interesting experience. Mm-hmm. Another point about that I remember when we did the Diversity of Voices campaign, I think there were like 5,000 people wrote into the CRTC, 3,000, something like that. There were several thousand anyway, right? And that, at the time, that was a fair number of people. It wasn't the largest, but it was a large number of people to write in. But when they went to sort of, you know, count it up and sort of compare like the other groups, it counted as one. It was like open same media, right? The same letter counts as one. But apparently not anymore. Apparently now they do count it as if you have a large number of people writing. Like when the 300,000 people wrote in for Stop the Meter, they couldn't count it as one anymore, right? So it was interesting to see them sort of rethinking on their part in that regard as well, right? So to answer your question, I think, yeah, that whole issue of language, although still, as you know, from my perspective, as a university professor perhaps too, right, I do think that's a little over the top. It does seem to work, and it has even been adopted by the government. So what the heck? Let's go for it.
There's a visceral reaction sometimes, you know, what gets
right.
you, you know, and it's that sort of punch.
Well, we were concerned, too, as you said, on complex issues. Presumably you're wanting to actually educate people about it, too, not just feed into a knee-jerk reaction if you're trying to really get policy debate. So, I don't know where I am on that mm-hmm. going forward.
I think it does get people thinking. And another thing about that language is it can that signifier can cover such a broad range. So you're getting people that are only thinking about it, perhaps in a more shallow way, although we don't know, right, to people that are thinking about it much more complexly. And one thing about what Open Media has discovered there, too, I think, is that many people do think about these issues in much more complex manner than we're often given credit for, right? And so sometimes those, I think that shallow language does work as a double-edged sword, but it seems to be of effect. Okay. Bob or anybody?
No, that's fine.
Mr. Hackett, you mentioned the Fraser Institute, but there's also, especially in Quebec, this ongoing Radio-Canada bashing from Québécois. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same in English Canada against CBC. And I was wondering if you think it takes another sort of campaign to push back these attacks, because it just looks like CBC or Radio-Canada against Québécois, you know, and people just watch it as a war going on, and I'm not sure they want to engage, you know?
Yeah. You know, I remember speaking years ago to a CBC producer who's now deceased, Jim Littleton, used to work for radio, I believe, who said it actually would have been very useful if there were a counterweight to the Fraser Institute's monitoring of CBC's coverage on news, that he would have found it very useful, you know, if there were a left-wing critique that was out there, right, of CBC, and it would have helped to, you know, bring a better sense of balance and perspective to CBC's editorial decision-making. So I think that's what it would take, actually. I think we do need to engage with this issue. I don't think it doesn't seem to me like the kind of issue that Open Media would take on, likely given its own mandate, but other groups perhaps could, because it's more focused on journalism and on content, on the question of political bias mm-hmm. that a number of groups, I think, are very afraid to sort of touch. But I think it would need to be backed by real, solid research, mm-hmm. which could be done. I think the evidence is there.
Actually,
in terms of the framing of issues. You mean their in-house...
They've done an in-house study mm-hmm. on bias.
Yeah.
Je crois que c'est bilingue aussi, études qu'ils ont fait.
But from
so
what
there there may be ways of supplementing.
Yeah, but what they do, though, my understanding is their in-house content analysis tends to be fairly, I don't know if I should say superficial, but to focus on, you know, who's interviewed, just the question of access of,
right.
you know, who gets on as a source.
Mm-hmm.
Which doesn't get to the questions of framing and what issues arise in the first place, where you need some sort of comparative benchmark to evaluate it. So in a sense, there's a role that we should put in our list for, you know, academics to do. It's not sexy work, believe me. I've done it, okay? I've coded, 2,000 television news articles for items for my doctoral dissertation, and that was enough for my lifetime. Thanks very much, but... So it's not the kind of sort of, you know, spectacular theorizing that's going to get you, you know, 5 gold stars in the sort of, you know, the academia competition for stardom. But it's something that really is really, you know, necessary and important for the public interest. And maybe we could organize projects, for example, through journalism schools have classes that do media monitoring. Why not? We've done it before and from time to time at SFU. Mm-hmm. Maybe other schools can take that up as well.
Thanks. Hi. Karen, you mentioned that there was tensions inside open media between sort of a libertarian thread and people that might be more interested in public policy. And at the same time, open media is being approached by policymakers for recommendations. So I'm wondering how that's playing out in terms of the flavor of their policy recommendations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good question. And I don't, the tensions are ongoing. I mean, I think the policies that open media has sort of stood for on the telecom side are fairly, I mean, they may seem radical to the telecom companies at this point, but they're fairly moderate, actually. I mean, really just open up space for more private telecom companies. That's been their main stand on the whole auction of spectrum that's coming up, which I don't know how much we want to get into this, but... But they've also supported, at the same time, the idea of setting aside spectrum for public innovation and public uses. So, they have a fairly sophisticated sense of policy, and partly it's because there are people who are experts in policy who they go to and talk to about this stuff. So, which is good. But yeah, I mean, the libertarian tension that runs through it is not, I don't think, within the staff or within the activist organizations. It's really within the, you know, among those 500,000 people that have signed a petition, some proportion of those is really just wants to pay less for their internet and could give a shit about anything else, right? And so they don't want to pay more taxes to support any public thing. They just want to pay less for their internet. So I think that's always the tension for any organization that has somewhat of a consumer base or people who see themselves as consumers. And I think that will be the tension going forward is, you know, is this a citizen-based organization that places citizenship, at meaning not big C citizenship, but actual digital citizenship, democratic citizenship, active involvement in the debates and the discussions of everyday life, or is this really about cheaper internet? And I think that tension is not resolved. But there is a fairly sophisticated and nuanced approach to policymaking. Sometimes, what I will say is sometimes I'm a bit uncomfortable because it does seem instrumentalist, right? Like, what? But this is always what you do. At some point, you make a decision. Where can we get Christian Paradis or Harper to move? Like, where's what realm? What space have we opened up for this? And that's always going to be, you know, what could we actually get out of this? And should we get something out of this for 500,000 people who've supported us, or should we keep trying to push the stone forward so that in 20 years we can get? I mean, this is always the tension with these kinds of action-oriented campaigns, right? How far can you push the stone up the hill? And if you stop too short, you can claim a victory, but perhaps you've lost an opportunity for more. So I think that is a problem that I think we all worry about that. I think Steve worries about it. It's an unresolved question for sure. It's a good one.
Yeah.
It's really important politically.
Yeah, I don't want to hog the mic, but if nobody else had an immediate question.
There's someone back.
Oh, there is?
Okay, well, why don't you give them a go?
Sorry, I didn't see you.
Look, thanks very much to the panel. Last night I mentioned the organisation GetUp, which is seems to have a narrower brief in Australia, but a similar one in many ways. But in many ways, what you've been talking about to me seems to me is what journalism should be doing, but is not doing here and many other places, and is unlikely to do, I guess, because of the, you know, people are employed in many of these organisations, so they're not going to criticise the people who pay their bills. But can any of the members on the panel suggest how open media, has it changed journalism in Canada?
Has it changed journalism?
Do you want to answer that?
One thing I would like to say is I think it has changed how digital policy issues are talked about in the media, because it used to be that you would, you know, very rarely, it would only be on the business pages that you might hear about a CRTC hearing or something related to telecom or what in the mid-1990s was called the information highway, and nobody really gave a hoot about it, so it was never much talked about, and now it's really pleasantly surprising, particularly as a, you know, like David, as a university professor teaching the sort of stuff that is out there in the media and your students can grab onto it. So it is a lot in the mainstream media, whether it be Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, you know, any of the CanWest papers and so on and so forth. So I think it's pretty incredible the impact they've had on mainstream media in terms of talking about these issues and getting the word out there. So that's one aspect that I think is fabulous.
Exactly on this, as a practical way of saying things, in the media, when we talk about media, public says we're talking about our belly button. Yeah. So it's kind of hard also to cover media in mainstream media, because it's a lot of the criticism comes from, well, it's an industry kind of thing. So talk about your things in your journal, industry journal, and don't come and take pages in our mainstream media. So how do we do it then? And that's one question. And my other question is, how can we balance not having a free internet and from government control or surveillance, whatever you call it, and having at the same time a policy that respect the writers' rights. Mm. That's another, as a freelancer, is something that really not bothers me, but it's something that we have all in our minds, because we want to be respected as freelancer and keep our rights. And presently in the media, especially in Quebec, if you don't give up your rights, like all of it, you don't work. Mm-hmm. So it's a big issue for us.
Can I just address the first part? Mm-hmm. How can media, it's a good question, how can media cover themselves? It can be done. I mean, if you consider the Guardian in Britain, right, has a regular media section. I think it's probably weekly, and specialized reporters who cover media issues, because, you know, the editors realize it has become a major political as well as economic and consumer issue, right? And certainly in Britain, that's quite clearly the case with all the scandals involving the Murdoch Empire and so on. So I think that would be one way to go, have specialized media reporters. With some degree, obviously, they'd have to have some kind of independence from the media organization that they're writing through or with. So whether that's done through mainstream, you know, conventional media organizations, or specialized, maybe online critiques, you know, critics through blogs and so on, who somehow need to find a way to finance themselves. But I think it can be done once that, you know, journalists recognize that their work actually is a subject of major public interest. Okay.
Well, I work for a media union, and I can tell you there are two things that are almost impossible to get covered in any of our member publications, any of our members to cover, and that's media and labor. So absolutely it can be done. Québécois covers the media every freaking day. Now, they don't do it well, I would say, but they do it every day. They devote a lot of airtime, certainly in English Canada, I think less on TVA and LCN, but they certainly on Sun News talk about media probably 23 and a half out of 24 hours a day, and always about the CBC. And they talk about media. They devote probably a page a week to something about the CBC in their Sunshine newspapers, and probably in Journal de Montréal and Journal de Québec. I don't see those every day. So they talk about the media all the time. And, you know, the Globe has a media reporter that tends to cover the business side, but nobody covers the media. Nobody, I don't think. There is a single working journalist, not
non-freelancer who is paid to cover the media from the point of view of the rest of us. And that is a huge problem in this country. It's a mistake. Le Devoir does it. Yeah. Media column. And, you know, in Le Monde, in the French paper, there's a whole media page. Right? In Le Monde and Le Devoir. Yeah, it's true. Sorry, I was thinking. Still, that no, it's important. And Le Devoir is like the last independent newspaper, right? I mean, this is our problem. When we talk about the media, Lise and I, our vice president, who go to the CRTC a lot together, who's going to cover this stuff? And we say it actually needs to be the CBC. The CBC needs to cover it, but they're so scared of covering the media. But we've been trying to convince them, you guys actually need, who else is going to do it in this country except Le Devoir, Radio-Canada and CBC, because they don't, I mean, anybody else who does it really has too much skin in the game, and their reporters feel uncomfortable. They know when they're reporting the media, the publisher's breathing down their neck. Who is going to do it except those people? So I think it is a great question and a really important one to keep pushing. It would actually be something kind of minor to come out of this conference to say we actually need the media to cover media issues, not from their boardrooms, but from our perspective.
The public, or explaining to the public that it is a political issue, not just a belly button rubbing.
Right, exactly.
Just a couple of points. First of all, on this last question, a little bit of a plug for jsource.ca, which is the portal for news and information about issues related to journalism, and they actually have paid reporters who are journalism students and they also take voluntary contributions, and there are a number of sections, and so many of them do they do try to, perhaps not as systematically as anybody would like, but they do try to cover a lot of these issues. It'd be great to actually get a JSource reporter covering CRTC hearings, and maybe that's something we could suggest to our colleagues at Carleton. But on the larger question, a couple of things have come up. One of them is the person behind me suggested this problem with the word media, and I think it really is a problem with the word media, because when people hear media, they hear a whole lot of different things depending on what the context is. And I think a lot of the time, the comment was, well, when people hear us wanting to cover the media, they think it's just us talking about themselves. And that's because when we don't use terms, we say media, and sometimes we mean news media, sometimes we mean entertainment media, sometimes we mean access to the internet. We use the word media loosely to describe a whole number of things. And I think if, perhaps there were a little more precision around how we use that word, it might be a little bit more productive. Finally, I just, Karen, I mean, I think it's a little unfair to suggest that everybody who doesn't sign on to the entire project of democratic access and so on is just somebody who wants to get cheaper internet. I think there's a big difference. I think there's a much broader constituency for universal access and neutrality than there is for things such as mandated access to privately owned media, policy incentives to influence the kind of media that we have to foster new actors in the game, which is open to the suggestion that somebody's picking winners and losers and all that kind of stuff. I mean, these are, we can have important debates about these things, but I think it's unfair to suggest that, everybody who doesn't sign on to the whole project is, just acting as a consumer and not as a, not as a person that has, contributions to make to the policy, the policy side of it as well. And I've found this discussion really interesting because to hear that there are these discussions going on, and there's been an evolution in this direction.
Maybe the session for them.
Finally, it's Paul 1, Energizer Bunny, nothing.
Yeah.
I've been waiting for
Maybe it's time for
I think these are to hear about the evolution of open media, and I think it's really interesting because I think what they've discovered is that if you want to get short-term gains, if you want to get short-term reforms, if you want to get short-term policy initiatives put forward, you really do have to park the broader thing and in pursuit of that objective. And since I feel desperately that there's an important, there's really important to bring people together rather than divide, look for things that bring as many people together then, rather than things that divide people. And we're talking about people who do journalism in this country at this time. There's, once again, going to be, even among that community, a much broader constituency for digital access issues than for content-related issues.
Yeah. So I didn't mean to dismiss a lot, people who sign on and don't sign on to the full project, but I'm just telling you that we know that there are people who vehemently oppose. That's the problem, right? So there's a tension. There's a political tension among people who will say, I will stop supporting the project if you go down this road. And so it is a very difficult political road to navigate. And you will end up closing off avenues one way or the other. And I think it's still open. It's open media. It's still open as to where the road is, actually. And I think nobody knows. We don't have the map. So it's just an interesting tension. But I can tell you there are people on there who really, they say, I don't know what their political motivations are, but they will tell Steve and the gang, all I want is cheaper internet. Don't waste my time trying to get all these other things. In fact, I don't want those things. So that becomes a difficult, and I don't want to put words in Steve's mouth, but I think it's a bit like that. So that becomes a very difficult tension for some of the broader things. Now, a lot of those people also don't like the spying. So there's a lot of projects that line up. Right? Because, they don't want the state in their bedrooms or in their internet connection, and they also want to pay less for internet. So there's a lot of good campaigns that can converge there, and that's what is going on right now, which is fantastic. But it means other avenues could close down as a result of going in one direction and closing off others. That's the tension. Right.
Just tactically, one way of dealing with that, I think other organizations have adopted, is to sort of hive off some of their campaigns and make them kind of semi-autonomous. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Greenpeace, which years ago ticked off a lot of people with their Save the Seals campaign, mm-hmm. people who would support them on other issues. So they sort of made it a separate entity, and sometimes maybe didn't even really brand it themselves, right, put their name on it, but find other partners and run it as something separate, that's not quite us, right? You can support us without necessarily contributing to stopping the seal hunt.
Here's one area where the language is illustrated, is in this no internet lockdown campaign. So, and really, I mean, this is a copyright campaign. But the way that it's framed, and it's a copyright campaign that's quite complex in the both it's national as well as international, right? And trying to encompass these different dimensions. But it's framed in this way that develops a very populist sort of dimension to it, right? That framing, and this is what I think that Steve, I know, has spent a long time working on, is like he'll sit and watch the blogs and the people blogging about these ideas and really try and get a sense of to develop sort of the broadest way of framing these things, where still to incorporate, the larger sort of critical dimensions that they feel are crucial to have in there, right? But at the same time, appealing to this broader audience. And many times, and one thing that when this first happened, I remember having an argument with them and saying, why are you just appealing, to sort of the lowest common denominator, and you got a lot of people in here that really don't have any buy-in or don't really have any sort of knowledge of it. And he was, very quick to defend his constituency and point out that that wasn't the case at all, and that although it, oftentimes people may even have opposing opinions, often they're quite complex and well thought out perspectives. So it's very difficult to contend with those in a brief kind of way or a superficial way. So really, like thinking this framing issue in developing these frames, you really are dealing with a very intellectually sort of. I would say profound, but they're work with people that are really thinking about these things in complex ways, right? So it's hard to try and develop that. Anyway, I don't know where we are. How are we doing?
I think I've gotten a high five almost, which is great. So I want to thank the organizers, and particularly Christine and Errol for the thousands of emails and whatnot, and others that have been involved in this conference. Thank you very much, and thank you for coming out on a Saturday, and do check out openmedia.ca, and thank you very much.
Thank you. I think that's a great way to kick off our discussions that we're going to be having over the next little while. Just to keep us on schedule, I think if you don't mind too much, I'm going to cut the coffee break a little bit shorter. You can bring your coffee and your muffins and whatnot into your discussion rooms. Downstairs, where we have the coffee, you'll find sign-up sheets for our workshops. There are 4 workshops based on the presentations that we had during the day yesterday. So we've got the working definitions group. I'm going to be in that group.
10 minutes for coffee tasting. We have 2 hours for workshops. We got plenty.
No. We are. We're not going to take a half hour, Simon. Is what I'm saying. So we'll over the next 15 minutes while we have our coffee. We will sign up, if you don't mind, for the workshop. So the working definitions group, we will have the regulatory policies group. Errol's going to be part of that. We'll have Simon's group, which is the financial policies. And we will have Gretchen's group, which is organizational policies. We'll be upstairs in the small boardrooms for that. So you just take these stairs up, and each one of us will be standing outside the door so that you know where to go.
And if there's...
Exactly. Okay. Thank you.